1900, the population of Christians in Turkey was 32%. By 1927, it was just 1.8%. What happened? Well, it's an estimation that about 1.5 million Armenian and Assyrian Christians died in that period. Many were murdered. Others died from exhaustion or illness as they sought to flee, seeking refuge throughout the Middle East. What's astonishing is that about 100 years later, which is where we are today, sadly the same thing seems to be happening. The rise of Islamic State means that history is repeating itself. And we might think just this evening of brothers and sisters in Christ who somehow, whilst on the run, can you imagine that tonight, if we were having to be on the run, amidst the grief, the fear, they're gathering together to rejoice in the name of Jesus Christ. But of course, that is the pattern for God's people throughout history, isn't it? Whether it's the Roman Empire under Nero, or Cambodia under Pol Pot, or now in the Middle East and Islamic State, human history is so often, sadly, a testimony to terror. And inevitably, we ask the question, why? Why does God allow this? And particularly, why does God allow this kind of suffering among his own people? Two options. Is he simply just too weak? Or does he not care? And those aren't questions that are just for those who are unsure about Christianity. We all ask it. In fact, the circumstances of life keep us asking that question, don't they? And I don't know among us this evening what we're facing where we ask those questions. Well, the opening chapter of Exodus, you get the impression that those are exactly the sort of questions that God's people must have been asking, don't you? At the start, though, in the first seven verses, it looks like everything's going pretty well. It's looking pretty good. You know, in a good film, particularly a historical film, that sometimes you get a kind of little paragraph on the screen to kind of get you up to date with what's going on, don't you? Yeah, particularly if you don't know the history of whatever the historical film was about. And that's what you're kind of getting in those first seven verses. I summarized it like this, and if I was the director, this is what I would have on the screen as you're sitting there in the cinema and it comes up and you imagine the scene of all these people in Egypt. And I would have blazing across the screen, hundreds of years before, one extended family went to Egypt seeking refuge. They numbered only 70. But from that 70, a nation was born. That's the kind of heading you would have in chapter 1, verses 1 to 7. If you were doing the film of Exodus, that's what you would have. Because verse 1 to 7 reminds us that we're in the middle of a story. A story that takes us back to the book of Genesis, and particularly the story of Joseph. Notice how often Joseph is mentioned in those opening verses. Remember, Joseph is the boy who's the favorite of Jacob. He's the one of the technicolored dream coat, that kind of stuff, that Joseph. And remember, Joseph, of course, had saved his family. His ability to understand dreams had helped Pharaoh, if you remember, in Genesis, and he rose to become like the prime minister of Egypt, if you like. And he oversaw the storing of grain, didn't he, in that terrible famine that the Egyptians and the surrounding nations experienced. And that brought blessing, of course, on Egypt, but also upon Joseph's own family. And look how blessed they are in verse 7. The Israelites were fruitful and multiplied greatly and became exceedingly numerous so that the land was filled with them. That's about four different ways of saying exactly the same thing, isn't it? There were lots and lots of Israelites. Yeah? They were fruitful. Okay, there were a lot of them. They multiplied greatly. Okay, there's a lot of them. And the land became exceedingly numerous. Okay, there was a lot of them. So the land was filled with them. There were a lot of Israelites. That's the point. It's looking very good for God's people. In fact, we might think we recognize that kind of language of verse 7. Where have we seen that kind of language in Genesis and the story of Genesis before? Well, let's think of Joseph's great-granddad. Who was that, you're thinking? Abraham. Remember one night, God said, Abraham, I know you're outside your tent, you're kind of having a think. You don't trust my promise that I will bless the whole world through you. Well, just have a look up at the stars, Abraham. Give him a count. I wonder when he stopped counting. Or if you prefer, go down to the beach. Run through a few sands of grain in your hands. Start counting, Abraham. And you see, here God is answering his own promise. I'm going to bless you, Abraham. I'm going to make you numerous as the sand upon the seashore. It's happening. There's multiplication everywhere. If you're into maths and you like long multiplication, this is your passage, because everywhere it's multiplication of God's people. It's a mathematician's joy. And it's not simply that they multiplied greatly. The original language has the idea of teeming, swarming. The land was swarming and teeming with Israelites. Again, where have you heard that language before? Isn't it the language of Genesis chapter 1 and creation? A fruitful people here, a numerous people here, an abundant people here. You see, God is starting a new creation, it seems, with this people, this family. Because through this family, the whole earth will be blessed. It's a new creation. It's looking very good for God's people. And then verse 8 comes and slaps you in the face. We go from blessing to oppression. What's happening in verse 8? A new king, a new pharaoh comes to power. And notice he did not know about Joseph. This pharaoh had been paying no attention in his history lessons at school. He doesn't know how good God's people had been for the Egyptians. And his descendants, Joseph's descendants, now have this pharaoh reaching for the paracetamol. They've given him a serious headache, haven't they? Look at verse 9 and 10. Look, he said to his people, the pharaoh, the Israelites have become much too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they'll become even more numerous. And if war breaks out, they'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. I don't know about you, but I picture Pharaoh here in his kind of war cabinet council. His advisors are there around the table with him. And he's saying things like, they come over here and they steal our jobs. They're a fifth column. They're the enemy within. And you sense that Pharaoh here is a dangerous man. Notice he wants to deal shrewdly with the Israelites, but he's also very confused, which is a pretty dangerous combination, isn't it? To be shrewd and confused at the same time. He also wants to keep their numbers down, but he doesn't want them to leave. Do you see that? He's shrewd and confused. I want to keep their numbers down, but I don't want them to leave. I don't want them to run away. That's the end of verse 10, isn't it? They'll join our enemies, so we better keep the numbers down, but then they might leave the country, do you see, at the end of the verse. You can hear his public speech, can't you? He's saying, immigration is good for the economy. We're pleased that they're here, but we need to protect the home population. And so oppression follows. In fact, it's really like a boxing match, to be honest. A boxing match, if you like, between Pharaoh on the one hand, who's in the red corner, if you like, and then there's God in the other corner. It isn't really going to be much of a match, is it? Well, there are three rounds to this boxing match. Round one is 11 to 14. What does he do? But put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor. They build these cities, Pithom and Ramses, as store cities. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with hard labor in brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their hard labor, the Egyptians used them ruthlessly. Pharaoh's jab, if you like, his first swing at God is, well, let's work these people to death. And so you might imagine the letter arrives in every home of every Israelite household. It's from the Department of Immigration. We're pleased to inform you of your privileged new status of guaranteed labor in Egypt. It's like the ghettos of Nazi Germany, isn't it? The Yellow Star, a forced labor camp. You dress it up as you want, but verse 13 and 14, they worked them ruthlessly. This is violent oppression. That's what it's like to serve under Pharaoh. Now, I want to step back from this just for a moment. It is not the main point from this passage today, but it's worth saying, because throughout the book of Exodus, Pharaoh and the pharaohs are painted as idols, false gods who are in opposition to the one and true God. And any service under one who rivals God, well, is ruthless oppression. And let's just narrow that down into our lives. It doesn't have to be physical rulers, does it? I'm talking about idolatry in our lives in general. These things can be good things that have been twisted. The idolatry of family, the idolatry of academic success, the idolatry of money, whatever it is, as it masters us and controls us, it's twisted and it leads to bitterness. Ruthless oppression over us. That's what we see in our world, isn't it? Idols ruthlessly oppressing God's people and the world. But they're nothing in comparison to the one and true God. The Pharaoh thinks he can pack a punch, doesn't he? He thinks he can strike at God's people and get a victory. But look at what he gets in response in verse 12. The more that they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. If Pharaoh thought they were numerous before, he needs a new abacus, doesn't he? Because now they're in dread of the Israelites. Dread, do you see? The Egyptians came to dread the Israelites, verse 12. You see, poor Pharaoh doesn't realize that he's the prototype throughout history, does he? He's a first in the long line of those who've tried to wipe out God's people, only to find, as you try and wipe out God's people, exactly the opposite effect occurs. Here's a phrase I want you to remember from this evening. The greater the oppression, the greater the growth. The greater the oppression, the greater the growth. The two are interconnected. They're interwoven. Isn't that amazing how God works like that? He's done it all through history. Think of the Romans. They systematically tried to destroy Christianity. You'll know the stories of the Christians and the lions. But what happened? Eventually the Roman Empire became Christian, and the gospel came with it. Think of our own history in this country. Bishops Latimer and Ridley were burned at the stake in the middle of Oxford in 1555. And this is what Latimer said to Ridley. Be of good comfort, Master Ridley. Play the man. We shall this day light such a candle by God's grace in England as shall never be put out. Now I want to say, amazing as Latimer and Ridley were, he actually underestimated what God was going to do. Because the light went from people like Latimer and Ridley and those like them, beyond just the English-speaking world, didn't it, as the gospel went forth. Well, think of China today, the world's new superpower. It will be the greatest nation on earth in the coming decades, won't it? What happened there under the Cultural Revolution? What did Chairman Mao do? Well, churches were shut down. Pastors were imprisoned. It was illegal to own a Bible. Do you know, in China in 1949, there were under 1 million Christians. Do you know how many there are expected to be in 2025? 160 million. Greater the oppression, the greater the growth. Do you know, I think that's a massive encouragement to us, isn't it? Because we are currently in a climate in this country where even a conservative government, which apparently in the past has supposedly been Christian in some form or another, a conservative government is going to be passing laws on extremism, which is going to embroil Christians. Because in years ahead, and I don't figure it's going to be too many, Christians are going to be charged with extremism for holding a biblical view on human sexuality. It's going to happen. But the greater the oppression, the greater the growth. You see, Pharaoh doesn't know what he's in for, does he? He's the first in the ring. And he comes with a very sore lip at the end of round one, so round two he tries a different strategy, doesn't he? It's call the midwife, if you like that series, but that's basically what he does. He calls the midwives, doesn't he, in verse 15. He said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiphrah and Puah, when you help the Hebrew women in childbirth, observe them on the delivery stool. If it's a boy, kill him, but if it's a girl, let her live. Notice we hear of their names, Shiphrah and Puah. But Pharaoh, king of Egypt, you never know who he is. Do you think there's a point there? You see, his policy this time is not one that you want to make public, do you? So the official memo, imagine it arriving at the maternity ward, and Shiphrah and Puah are invited to the palace. They're busy, so they're pleased for the rest. They're very busy, aren't they, with all these Hebrew children being born. But in hushed tones, they're told, and presumably the other midwives that they lead are told too, verse 16, kill the boys and let the girls live. Now, don't miss this. The original text here has sons and daughters. Boys and girls just seems a bit more cold, doesn't it? That these were someone's sons. Here's a planned secretive slaughter. Kill off the sons, reduce the population, it works. Take away any possibility of them joining Egyptian enemies. It's the shuffling of Pharaoh's feet in the ring, isn't it, as he tries to take another swipe at God. But it's again a swing and a big miss. We don't know how long passes between verse 17 and 18, but presumably it's a number of years. The natural course of events would take a while to be noticed, wouldn't they? Because it does take 9 months or so for babies to be born. That's what we know. It takes a while, presumably, for Pharaoh to notice that all the people he were wandering around thinking were little girls are actually little boys dressed up as little girls, because he doesn't realize what's going on. Now, I'm going to pass over the slight exaggeration that Shiphrah and Puah clearly tell to Pharaoh in verse 19. If you want to, the writer doesn't tell us whether it's a lie or not. You can come and ask me afterwards what I think about it, but I'm not going to pause there for now. But it's clear that these two women go down as heroines, don't they, of the faith? They're examples, actually, for us. Here's an example of those who put the fear of God over the fear of man. And you can imagine later generations reading this saying, yeah, Mum told me that Shiphrah was my midwife. Who was yours? Was it Puah or was it Shiphrah? And there's more than a touch of irony, I think, isn't there? Pharaoh wants to use those who bring life into the world to bring death. And his plan so spectacularly backfires that not only do Israelites again multiply, do you see that again in verse 20? They became even more numerous. Well, Shiphrah and Puah, they get pregnant as well. Isn't that great? They go on maternity leave. And I assume that's also at the Egyptian government's expense in verse 21. they had families themselves. You see, the greater the oppression, the greater the growth. And as the bell goes at the end of round two, you can imagine Pharaoh kind of staggering back in his corner. But that's, of course, when somebody's at their most dangerous, when they've got nothing now to lose. Lashing out in frenzy. And round three is pretty short. It's verse 22. And Pharaoh gave this order to all his people. Every boy that is born, you must throw into the Nile. But let every girl live. Well, it's now public, isn't it? Pharaoh's policy. It's an order notice for all people, all his people. Now, it might help to know here that the Nile was the god of life to the Egyptians. They worshipped the Nile because it brought life through its water to a dry land. But the Nile becomes death to the Israelites. It will swallow up the lives of these sons. It's a terrifying scene, actually, isn't it? Verse 22 is very, very brief, but we are supposed to read between the lines. You can imagine the house-to-house searches, can't you? Screaming infants pulled from the arms of parents. It's genocide equivalent to the killing fields of Cambodia, to the northern towns of Iraq. Imagine what Islamic State are doing as we're sat here this evening. If I was doing a series with you on Exodus, I'd leave chapter 2 till next week, and I'm not going to preach on it all here, I promise you. But you can't leave chapter 2, the beginning of it, just here, can you? Because chapter 2, the beginning of it, just gives us a camera shift. We go from the wide-angle lens, if you like, in the film of chapter 1, the big picture of what's happening in Israel, to focus on one family and one particular son who should have ended up in the River Nile too. And of course he does, but in a very different way. And the irony being that out of the water of death comes life, deliverance. Moses, this boy, will be brought up right under the nose of the man who's made it his mission to destroy people like Moses. And you might imagine Pharaoh sitting on the balcony of his palace, and while his daughter, his own daughter, is pushing a buggy around the grounds and with a little Jewish boy in it. He's paying for the foods on Moses' table. He's put royal robes on Moses' back. And no doubt he even paid for the school fees. Don't you think this is hugely ironic? Pharaoh is raising up the one who will eventually bring him down. Do you get it? You cannot stop God's plan. Victory is just the seam that runs through this opening chapter. And as readers, we see it. The greater the oppression, the greater the growth. You can't stop God. And the first readers of this book, of course, the generation who actually got to the promised land, they would have seen it, wouldn't they? As they looked back and read these opening verses about their ancestors, imagine the 12 tribes on the verge of the River Jordan as they're about to go into the promised land. And so the opening verses are read out, and those names of the tribes, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, and you can imagine the tribes gathered in their thousands going, "Oh, Reuben, hey, that's us! Gad, hey, that's us!" It's like a rock concert, thousands of people there. These opening verses, just reminding them of their roots. They were just a few. There was just 70-odd of them, but they became a many. And not even the greatest superpower of the day could stop them. But what about those who actually experienced life and death under Pharaoh? Because this went on for generations, didn't it? The pain of slavery was real. Moses is going to be 80-odd years old before God sends him back. Imagine the calloused hands of those who'd been forced to work hard with those bricks. Imagine the brokenness of their bodies and their minds, the hunger in the belly, the grief as another one failed to make it. Imagine the grief of those parents. Let's not gloss over the pain. Because for them, in the middle of it, do you know what? It would have appeared pointless, and it would have appeared helpless and hopeless. They didn't have the great benefit of hindsight. They didn't know that God was hearing and seeing and knowing their pain, as it says at the end of chapter 2. They didn't know that in the midst of all of this mess, God was carrying out his purposes to keep his promises to Abraham. To the Israelites, he appears silent. If you're in the middle of it. And in the three rounds that we've had in that boxing match I've kind of used as an illustration this evening, the only voice that they hear, what is the only voice you hear in this? Whose is the only voice you hear but Pharaoh's? One commentator writes on this passage, experience without explanation, adversity without purpose, hostility without protection. That is how life will always appear for the earthly people of God. Sorry, that's not much fun for us, is it? The present circumstances are real in the sense that we experience them. They are painful, but you know what this passage says? They are not the reality. We are seeing behind the curtain, if you like. C.S. Lewis, the writer, says we live in the shadow lands. We don't have the ability to see the ultimate reality. We are God's creatures. We are not the creator. And it's our natural sense of grasping at him and of our sinful nature that says that we want to be the creator and we want to know what's going on and we desire to be in control. That is why we find it so hard. But we're his creatures. Do you see what this chapter is telling us in the opening part of Exodus? Trust God is faithful even when you have not got a clue what he's up to. Because life so often appears a mess, doesn't it? That's the pattern here in Exodus. That's the pattern for God's people in the Old Testament. That's the pattern for Jesus Christ, isn't it? For what does Moses' childhood foreshadow? But Jesus' childhood. What does Jesus have to do as a child but flee a king who's trying to kill him in his infancy? It's the pattern of his life. You most clearly see that clearly at the cross, don't you? Because for all the world, the cross looks like a failure, doesn't it? As his broken body is taken down and his disciples don't have a clue what God is up to. It looks like the Pharaohs of Jesus Christ's day had won. Yet in the moment of apparent defeat, victory. For sin is defeated and death is destroyed. And if it's the pattern for God the Son, it's a pattern for his bride, the church. He has not promised you or me health and wealth, if only you've got enough faith. He has not promised us to be free from persecution, in fact, precisely the opposite. Everyone who wants to live a godly life will be persecuted, we're told in Timothy. What he has promised is that he will keep his covenant promise that he made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob to multiply his people. How do we see that today? Not by having lots and lots of children, but by as the gospel advances, that he will bring his people safely to the promised land, not of a physical land in Israel, but the land of a new creation. So what does that look like for us here and now? What does this passage look like for you and me here and now? Well, three examples briefly to finish. Perhaps the recession. I still think we're in recession. They keep telling us we're not. But perhaps the recession, production goes down to 3 days a week. That happens, doesn't it? But in the extra time available, you start reading the Bible with a few colleagues. And you never expected that actually God would use that difficulty to bring about people converted. Well, how about this one? Perhaps the grades of your exams were not as good as you hoped for, or your grandchildren's exams, or your children's exams, and they go to a university that you didn't really want them to go to, like Sunderland University, which is pretty low on the list, I'm afraid. You don't expect that actually that's where they will hear the good news of Jesus Christ and they get converted. Or what about the church leader who I know who has a wife and three young daughters and is diagnosed with brain cancer in his early 40s? And he will never be around and is not anymore around to see all the hundreds of people who've been challenged by his hope in the resurrection. Those are real life stories of people with an Exodus 1 type testimony. Trusting God is faithful even when we haven't got a clue what he's doing. I'm going to close by telling you a story or an illustration which Don Carson, some of you all know the writer, Christian leader, has used, which I find extremely helpful. He says, imagine the grandeur of a great tapestry in a castle hall. You know, you've seen them when they're huge, the size of a wall like this. And imagine you're seeing it round the wrong way, on the back. It's a complete mess, isn't it? Just a jumbled mess of knots and threads, looking like they've just been placed in random. That's the side of the tapestry, if you like, that we see in this life. It appears like a tangled mess of unconnected threads. But one day, when Christ returns, we get to see the other side. How every thread has been beautifully connected and perfectly placed in bringing about his plan of salvation. God is faithful, even we haven't got a clue what he's up to. Let's pray, shall we?